Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we'll be taking a broad look at the year ahead. We're going to be delving into Morningstar's outlook for 2025. We're going to be looking at key opportunities and some of the most exciting markets that they see for the year ahead. And to do that, we're very kindly joined by Morningstar's Chief Investment Officer, Mike Coop. Mike, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Jonathan.
Before we get into it, it's going to be a very broad conversation. We're going to be looking at a number of key markets and potential playbooks for investors. But before we start off, would you be able to give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself as well as Morningstar, please?
Absolutely, Jonathan. So Morningstar is probably known to many people in financial services for its research, starting off with its fund research. But actually, these days, that research has extended to private assets, extended to public capital markets, it's extended to ESG research. Morningstar owns the fourth largest credit rating agency in the world, DBRS. So there aren't many parts of the investment universe that Morningstar doesn't cover with its research. So that's really what drives the investment decisions that are made by Morningstar's investment management operation. And I'm part of that. I'm part of the wealth business, which runs multi-asset portfolios in the form of managed portfolios and multi-asset funds. And we make that available through advisors. So our mission really is to think about the end investor and help them achieve their goals. And we devise investment strategies to do that and make them available. And those investment strategies are powered by this phenomenal amount of global research.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So as I said, it's going to be quite a broad discussion. We're going to be looking at a number of sectors a little bit later on in the podcast, as well as potential strategies. But I think a good place to start, Mike, would be looking at a geographical approach to investments in the coming year. And then from there, we can break down into individual sectors. So the team at Morningstar, Mike, where do you see the best opportunities on a geographical basis in 2025?
Well, Jonathan, the way that we look at markets is we tend to take a longer term view. And because that's what really aligns with investors achieving their goals. And as we look at the world, we use that research over how things are likely to play out over a full economic cycle and think about what is a reasonable price to pay to own assets, given the sort of earnings and cash flow and the risks related to that. So when we go through that process, what we find today is that some markets are trading at prices that reflect a very optimistic scenario, which could still come true, but you are finding that that optimism means that the share prices are high, whereas there are other markets and assets where people are adopting a much more pessimistic outlook. And although that could also occur when pessimism becomes extreme, what we found in the past is that prices are quite low and usually things don't turn out to be as bad as people expect. And that means those assets where markets are perceived to be risky and the outlook bad often end up being quite good investments. So as we look at the world today, it'd be no surprise that the US equity markets look richly priced and people are adopting an optimistic view about quite a few of the large companies that are tethered to the current investment spending around artificial intelligence, for example. So when we a step back to look at longer term, using our research, and Morningstar also has a large equity research team who specialize in individual company research, what we find is that there are still pockets of opportunity within the US and different industries that are available, and particularly smaller companies is an area that's still relatively overlooked. So we think within the US there are some opportunities there, but actually geographically, when we look around the world, we see more value in some of the emerging markets, and in particular, China and Brazil, where investors have very much adopted a glass half empty, in fact, a glass totally empty in the case of China, And then when we look outside of that, we can also see opportunities in Europe. The UK to us still stands out as offering better value than other developed markets. And that, we think, is a hangover from all the way back to the referendum on Brexit in 2016 and all the things that have happened since then. So that's a snapshot of some of the opportunities that we're seeing.
Thank you. And we're going to drill down into some of those themes in a little bit more detail. And it is going to be a conversation that focuses predominantly around equity. But I do want to touch on fixed income before we move on and explore equity in more detail, Mike, and look at the balance, because, of course, you know, where we sit today, we're looking at 10-year yields over in the US creeping steadily higher. So this is going to be something that's at the forefront of investors' minds. From where you're sitting, Mike, how do you see the balance of portfolios changing through 2025? You know, if somebody's employing a traditional 60-40 weighting between equities and fixed income, do you see any evolutions potential for those weightings in the year to come?
Well, I have to say, in the time when I've been investing, and I started my investment career in 1987, and over the course of my career, I've been an asset allocation strategist. I run money for multi-asset portfolios with big institutions, as well as for advisors, and looked at the research behind that. And making a call about switching between equities and bonds is something that's pretty difficult to do and consistently get it right. And that's because of the vagaries of a different economic data and the way the world works, the randomness and complexity makes it pretty hard to have a reliable economic forecast and market forecast. So the way that we tend to think about this issue is for each client who come to us and set out the sort of level of risk they're happy to take, we will create a mandate, and there'll be a bit of latitude within that mandate to take a bit more risk than usual or a bit less risk than usual, but still stay within the broad risk tolerance. So for clients in general, we've created an approach to identify extremes that will give us a steer as to whether it's time to take more or less risk than usual. And the way we do it is we look at three different things. We look at valuations as a whole of assets, and we ask the question, do we see overwhelming evidence that prices are so far above or so far below fair value that it's extreme? And at the moment, we are seeing more of those signs than we have historically when it comes to equities relative to fixed income in the US, and more signs in general than most of the last few years. But it's not extreme yet. But we are seeing that flashing an amber sign. The other two indicators we look at, and that amber sign would indicate that bonds are more attractive than equities. The other two things we look at, though, are not really flashing any warnings yet, and they are how easy it is for companies to raise capital. And at the moment, we're seeing there on the debt markets that certainly things have been easing back. You might remember after the Silicon Valley Bank went bankrupt in early 2023. We had that 24. We had that market reaction against financial service companies, and then we've seen that all row back as people have realized that those banks are very well capitalized, and we're not in for a rerun of 2008. So when we look at that, we are not seeing the sort of extremes on companies being able to raise capital really easily yet from debt or equity markets, but it's definitely getting easier to raise money in terms of debt than it was before, and we've seen a bit of a resurgence on equity capital raising. So at the moment, that's neutral, but it's sort of telling you that animal spirits are getting up, but not giving you a flashing sign. And the other of the three pillars we look at is really trying to get a good grip on investor sentiment. So typically when investors are very bullish and are overly optimistic, that's a warning signal. So we're not seeing anything there yet. Certainly we've seen an improvement in investor sentiment, but we're not seeing it reaching the extreme. So what all of that tells you is when you look at valuations, sentiment, and when you look at the supply of capital, we don't think there's a strong case for moving away from the normal levels of risk-taking that you'd have at the moment. And that means that you shouldn't be deviating heavily from your normal equity bond split. So that's how things stand today. What we found is that these metrics tend to evolve over time. And so if it were the case, for example, that we saw investors becoming more bullish, markets going up a lot in terms of equities and bond yields staying where they are, and it being very easy to raise money from by companies, from banks, and from equity markets, then that would start to steer us towards looking at the downside more to see what would happen if that unwound. But at this stage, we have a fairly neutral view on risk taking.
Thank you. So, you know, looking in the outlook for 2025, his report, and just a note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast because you'll be able to download Morningstar's outlook for 2025 in full. There is a clear differentiation between investors that may be looking for higher returns and taking a higher risk and those that are looking for a more modest return, of course, with the associated lower risk. So I think we would look at those two pots at this point in time, Mike. And you know, really the question is here, I think we'll start off with, you know, what are the most interesting opportunities you see for those investors that are seeking higher returns that may be able to tolerate a higher risk?
Thanks, Jonathan. So in that era, China is certainly one of those markets where there's a different degree of uncertainty related to how the government behaves. Having said that, many developed economies also have a pretty high degree of uncertainty and are in a state of transition in terms of their policy making as well. But in the case of China, I think that's an opportunity which is one better suited for those who can take a bit more risk and can also have the time horizon to be able to be patient and wait for that to play out. The asset prices are very depressed. There's been a turning point where investors cut their exposure to as low as they really could, and many exited. And at the same time, we had government policy, which at one point a few years ago was very restrictive, was intervening directly in companies for the sake of control, and was curtailing opportunities in some of the major sectors. That's now swung around and is much more supportive of growth and the economy in general, as well as companies. But we still see prices being pretty low compared to the prospects for what are some world-leading companies, which really have the Chinese economy to themselves because of the way protectionist policies of governments have played out. So that was one area for that. I think I mentioned US small companies. We don't see them as highly risky, but they're certainly a little bit more risky than some of the larger companies in terms of their sensitivity to the economic cycle. But we still see value in those, and there are good quality companies there, which are also well set up for dealing with a difficult economy as well. So those would be a couple I'd highlight on the higher risk. When it comes to a lower risk portfolio, we still think that fixed income, because of the level of yields and the fact that inflation has moved down and short-term interest rates are still quite high relative to inflation, that there's still opportunities for fixed income to provide decent returns and certainly a much better environment than would have been the case 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And so this is something that gives us more confidence for those investors who aren't taking much risk but still need a decent return. So fixed income as a whole. Government bonds look reasonable. Some investment grade corporate bond markets are looking a little bit miserly in terms of the extra return you get for taking the extra risk. So the additional yield you get is kind of lower than what we'd normally expect. So it's not the best time for taking that sort of risk, but government bonds are okay. We still see emerging market bonds also as attractive in terms of the risk reward as well, because of how they're running their fiscal policy and the current level of yields and current level of inflation and interest rates. So those would be ones. And on the equity side, for those who are have a short horizon and a less risk tolerant, then we'd see infrastructure, utilities, healthcare, consumer staples, all of being areas of interest. Those are also less sensitive to the ups and downs of the economic cycle and can provide some income yield.
Thank you. So we're going to move on and discuss some of the themes in more detail. But before we do that, Mike, there was something that I noticed when you're reading through the report. A lot of the assumptions and the thesis for investments for the coming year are built around interest rates, and in many cases, falling interest rates. What do you see as the biggest risk to these assumptions going forward? You know, that being that interest rates may not fall as quickly as some hope or think they will.
So we've seen in the course of 2024, there can be quite wild swings in investors' expectations around interest rates. And those swings in expectations can lead to bond prices moving around quite a lot. So at the start of 2024, investors were pricing in very large, in fact, unprecedentedly large and rapid reductions in interest rates. And as the course of the year went on, that those expectations swung around to be expecting less interest rate cuts. Where we are today is that, again, people have reined their expectations in for interest rate cuts, which is why we've seen bond yields increase compared to where they were 3-4 months ago. So we think some of that's already factored in, but there's certainly the potential for investors to get skittish again if there are any inflation numbers that come out that are higher than expected. I would say this, though, because short-term interest rates are really quite significantly higher than the level of inflation at the moment, because the economy has a fair amount of debt in it, and because we're already seeing signs of stress from that debt in terms of the increase in bankruptcies, then there is much more higher likelihood of interest rates being reduced than there is of interest rates going up. But the scenarios where that might be the case would really be a change in policies that could be inflationary. If there were to be across the board large tariffs introduced, for example, that's likely to bump up inflationary pressures, and any drastic change in immigration would also have some impacts on wage inflation as well. And so those things could affect the direction of interest rates. Central bankers look at the data and determine what that means for inflation down the track. So that's, for us, one of the things that's likely to be taken into account in terms of potential shocks. You know, it's too uncertain when it comes to the political machinations of the geopolitics and the various conflict zones to know what will happen there. But in general, the more conflict there is, the more inflationary it is, the less conflict, the less inflationary. So we are already at a point now where there's quite a bit of conflict. So changes in those geopolitical conflicts will have an impact. And there's obviously a scenario where if it gets worse or it extends, then that could be inflationary. That also could send bond yields up.
Thank you. That's fascinating. So we're going to move on now, Mike, to the themes. And the first one here is China, and you have discussed it in some detail as being a place for those that are maybe seeking higher returns to look. So the question here is really, how do you play that? You know, because of course there's various ways to get exposure to China. You know, is it a case of looking at mainland shares, Hong Kong shares, maybe shares that are listed around the world with exposure to China? What have you picked out for the year ahead as the best way of playing this?
Well, these days it's much more straightforward to take direct exposure through exchange-traded funds than it used to be in the past to mainland Chinese shares. So the big players, though, are also available through ADRs, and some of them you can access through other stock markets. To really, though, benefit, you'd really be looking to create a fairly broad-based exposure to the mainland larger companies. And so to do that, you're really looking at a direct Chinese stock market exposure rather than going through Hong Kong or limiting yourself to ADR. So that's how we would think about it. There's enough large companies there that are undervalued, that are dominant franchises, quite a range of different industries rather than the more traditional financial services, property-related industries that you tended in the past to be able to pick up by investing through Hong Kong.
Thank you. So moving on now, we have UK house builders. So Mike, I remember I think it was probably towards the beginning of last year or maybe the end of 2023, we welcomed your colleague, Michael Fields, who went through one of your quarterly outlooks and highlighted Persimmon, which then from that point proceeded to have quite a nice rally. And it is another sector that you've picked out to have a strong year again in 2025. So what are the main drivers for the UK house builders in the coming year?
Yeah, I don't think that's really changed in terms of its tailwinds from when Michael ran through, Michael Field, my colleague, ran through that earlier. You've just got a combination of a very out of favour sector and a turnaround in the fundamentals from a government policy perspective that are going to be much more supportive of construction than was previously the case. You've still got to deal with the big shift that's happened in interest rates over the last few years, but that's one of the reasons why the asset class or the shares sold off so much as well. So we think that, you know, well-managed companies in that space will still have a tailwind to come for many years, just given the scale of construction required to achieve the government's goals, as well as just the chronic degree of underbuilding that's been endemic in the UK. So the story remains the same.
Thank you. So artificial intelligence, Mike, of course, one of the big themes for the last couple of years, and just looking at the moves in US markets so far this year, it looks like it's going to be another big theme again. So that, you know, the first wave of the artificial intelligence rally in public markets was, of course, chip makers such as Nvidia. We saw a big rally yesterday in Micron Technology. So again, you know, these are all that the picks and shovels companies as such. Where do you see the second wave coming through from AI? You know, is it in infrastructure? Is it going to be applications? You know, it's something you've discussed in the report. So it'd be good to get a little bit of insight there.
Sure. So when we think about what this all means in the long run, it's worth bearing in mind that all previous examples where you've had a widely applicable, you know, breakthrough technology, the biggest beneficiaries of, in terms of companies, have seldom been the ones who were the leaders at the start. So it's worth being a little bit humble about forecasting precisely what will happen. I think in the first instance, there has been focus on where the spending has been and who has benefited most from that spending. And it's no surprise, as everyone knows, that it's been Nvidia and comparable companies that have been in the limelight there. And then you've had the companies who have been investing heavily to try and increase their capabilities in that area. And those are the ones that have already been bid up pretty highly so far. So with that, you know, and you can see that with, you know, the way that Microsoft and Alphabet, Amazon have performed during the course of the year. So typically what happens in the long run that's important is the adoption of that technology by companies. And this becomes a bit less sexy. It's really the boring, okay, how do I look at the process that I use for my company and how can I apply the benefits of AI to my process that will reduce my costs or allow me to do things I couldn't do before and will allow me to create new products and new services. So the thing about this, of course, is that people talk about artificial intelligence as if it only existed for the first time in 2004. Whereas, of course, there's been a progressive trend to technologies which have greater capability, but not many of those really are self-sufficient, fully generative capabilities. So there has been an acceleration in the so-called generative technologies. And as companies apply these and look to understand how they can improve the processes, that's when you start to really see a significant enhancement overall in the way businesses operate. So this is a progressive and continual adoption of these technologies rather than a switch that goes on or off. But what we're seeing more is the application of this. So you see the consulting firms also benefited from the help they were giving companies in applying the new technological breakthroughs. But at the end of the day, it's really down to how the companies apply for them. And the trade-off is just the cost of it. So at the moment, there's a huge amount of money that's being invested in AI. And we're still identifying ways for some of those companies to monetize that. And those ways have not become clear as yet, but the spending is very large. So a lot of that expectation of gains has been front-loaded. In the document, you can see the price of fair value estimates based on Morningstar equity research analysts, and that's a good gauge of whether or not the markets are underpricing it or overpricing it. But the next way is really going to be the adoption of it. And the odd thing is it's the least efficient companies who stand to benefit the most from this. So it'll probably be something that goes right through every single sector, and that's what our analysts are doing. They're really looking at, okay, what might this mean across all industries and which companies could benefit the most and what are they doing about it? But at this stage, there's not the sort of clear short-term small list of companies where you'd say, well, these are the ones to look for in 2025.
Thank you. So there is a section in the report that discusses the implementation of AI across sectors. And of course, that's something that your analysts will be working on. What are they looking for, Mike? You know, when you're looking in the real world, of course, we've discussed the chip makers, you know, they're very much behind the scenes, but, you know, there needs to be a real world solution of companies that are implementing this. And of course, one of the big things to start with is going to be cost savings. So when your analysts are looking at companies that are implementing AI well or not so well, what are the main gauges of effectiveness that they'll be looking for?
Well, again, because this is not a switch on, switch off, brand new area, it's really a case of many of these technologies have been evolving over a long period of time and have been adopted by companies. So in the document, we give an example of financial advisors and how they've been increasingly applying AI to do things that are as trivial as document meetings with clients, prepare presentations, ensure compliance, as well as just collecting and summarizing research. In the business, those sort of businesses, it can be something as simple as that. And it's a case of having to go into businesses and look at all of their processes rather than anything really clear. But I think that's an example of simply where you are able to do it. You're starting to see it where people or where businesses are using AI more for client interaction and prospect interaction. So all the screening that already happens when you try and communicate to a company either online or more directly, as well as any service or provision where there's a calculation that needs to be and data that needs to be collected and assessed. And so really it's those are some of the things that are in the front line already, the data collection analysis, the calculation requirements, the client interactions. And those are some of the things that have been able to help with bringing costs down. In terms of new products, that's a different proposition. Certainly bringing your cost structure down allows you to be able to offer a better price, and that can be quite an important way of setting yourself apart from your competitors. So at this point, yeah, that's really what we're seeing. In the document, we mentioned a couple of companies. ServiceNow's Professional Plus tier as an example where they've been able to do that. And we talk about Amazon, Alphabet, and Microsoft. So people can dive into that for more detail there, I think. The bottom line, to be brutal about it, is it has to show up in the profit margins of companies. And if it's not showing up on the profit margins and it's not showing up in sales growth, then it hasn't really been something that's meaningfully changed things. So that's the ultimate test of it. And that will just depend on each business as to how it derives those things.
Thank you. And yeah, and once again, do encourage people to check out the notes of this podcast and get stuck into that report, because Mike, we could be here all morning discussing the points there. So we've tried to pick out some of the most prevalent ones. And just to finish off, a nice summary and bring together some of the points that you've kindly highlighted today. If we look in very broad terms of risks and opportunities for the year ahead, what would you highlight are the most important ones for investors?
So I think it's great to bring it back to, at the end of the day, people need to think about their investment portfolio as a medium for them to achieve their life. Style goals. It's really a way of making sure that you're able to afford to purchase that house, pay the mortgage off, fund your retirement, fund education, whatever it is that you've identified as a priority in your lifestyle. So the portfolios are really a vehicle to do that, and they need to be able to deliver on that. And what we're looking at here is staying on track when you get these inevitable shocks that come through, and having things in your portfolio that allow you to not suddenly find your portfolio has plummeted in value, because there's something in there which is able to rise in value in those sort of scenarios. So geopolitical risks and the spillover effect, we mentioned that at the start of the podcast, and we just, in the document, we flag a few things there. Generally, as I mentioned, when there's conflict, it tends to be inflationary in terms initially for things like commodity prices, but it can also feed through into all sorts of prices with tariffs and with changes in supply chains. So there is inflation-linked bonds that you can buy, which are a way of, if you hold them to maturity, you're going to get an increase in the coupon, or the value of the debt that you're buying on maturity. And so that would be something for people to consider as a way of dealing with that. I think the other is, what happens in a crisis is that governments respond usually by needing, if there's a crisis that's hitting the economy and the economy is dropping off, then capital preservation is important. So I think shorter dated government bonds, we talked about the fact that we see interest rates being above inflation at the moment, but we think there's a firm foundation there to shorter dated bonds. And so we think that's a good bedrock to have in your portfolio when you have these sort of risks that pop up. And that's certainly been the experience. We're starting to see that more and more when you get shocks. People flock to safety, and shorter term government bonds have been a good area there. They're not so caught up by longer term inflationary implications as well. So that's one thing. I think the second sort of risk that we flag is high prices, so high valuations and a strong dollar. This means simply that even if there's optimistic expectations are met, it can still lead to disappointment in the absolute returns as prices eventually fall back to levels that are more consistent with how things play out. So when we did that, we mentioned small and mid-sized companies as being a less demanding area, which should be less impacted as well by that. Chinese tech firms, Latin American equities, and the European consumer cyclical stocks, the home builders, and also some of the automakers who've been beaten up pretty badly. So those things to us look like a good way to deal with that risk of rich equity valuations and a strong dollar. And then the third thing we're flagging there is really just the ups and downs of the global economy, so disappointing growth or recession. And here we think that having good quality government bonds are going to be important. And I think, the moment, as I mentioned earlier, we're in a situation where the increase in interest rates that has happened for the last few years is starting to show through and have some impacts on companies that were never really a great credit risk. So having a bond portfolio where you can be confident that you're going to get paid back is pretty important there. So I think that would be a critical factor. And we've also seen in the equity market, there are sectors like I mentioned earlier, like infrastructure, utilities, healthcare, and consumer staples, which tend to be a good way of dealing with recessionary conditions while still getting some growth. So those are some of the key ideas, and we've shown in the document some scenarios where and how those sorts of assets play out in different scenarios.
Thank you. And you know, just for a final time, anyone listening to this, do check out that, because those points that Mike has outlined there are very well illustrated in a number of charts that run through that. So do check out the notes to this podcast. So Mike, thank you very much for being on the podcast today. Very much appreciated. And hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
My absolute pleasure, Jonathan. And delight talking to you. I think these are things are so important for people to get the big picture right when they think about their investing decisions. So hopefully there's some takeaways that people can apply to their own portfolios from this session today.
Yes, definitely. And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you. Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.